Good morning, world diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig.
I have no idea what she's going to say next.
What am I supposed to say?
It's world travelers.
And we're going to say hello to Peter since he already came
since
online.
Since he's already here, we have a very special guest with a seasonal theme. Not a world restaurateur, but a restaurateur from the delightful community of Williamsburg, Virginia.
The Trellis is the name of his restaurant, and he is the owner, executive chef, and he is Marcel Desaulniers, who is, he's world-renowned as a chef, and he is a genius at these wonderful books having to do with chocolate, his latest being one we're going to discuss today, called I'm Dreaming of a Chocolate Christmas. Good morning, Marcel.
Well, merry chocolate to you, Anna.
You had fun with this book, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I've tried to have fun with all the books, but this one was seemed to be easy to have fun with.
You know, we have to mention your award-winning book, Death by Chocolate. It's the ne plus ultra. Did you get that French? of chocolate books, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm trying to break out from Demise by Chocolate, though, and I thought Dreaming of a Chocolate Christmas had a more positive finality to it.
Yeah, but that was also the basis of your television series.
That's correct.
And you are a James Beard Award winner many times, I believe. And your television series is popular, and it's going on in reruns, is it?
Yeah, yes, it is. I have people that say they wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And there it is.
And I'm on Discovery. It's a frightening thought.
But. Well, strangely, you say you're not a pastry chef.
Not by training. I'm soups and sauces are probably where I feel like I excel the most. But my mom imbued in myself and all my sisters a love for chocolate at an early age. And when we opened our restaurant in 1980, I wanted to concentrate on chocolate desserts.
Now, your background is French-Canadian, born and raised in Rhode Island.
That's right.
A CIA graduate from New Haven. Where were you from?
New Haven, Connecticut.
New Haven, the old school. That's where the culinary institute was before it moved. Before it moved. So it was current.
But this is a fascinating book because it's not just about Christmas. It's got all the words associated with Christmas. Talk us through the different themes that you put in there.
Well,
I'm dreaming of a...
Again, I wanted to create a book that was enjoyable for people, and most importantly, a book that primarily had recipes that were accessible and wouldn't confine you to the kitchen for many hours during the holiday season. And although my publisher, which they did a great job with producing the book, they probably put the most difficult recipe in the book on the cover.
I mean, when they said this was easy, I'm looking at this chocolate lattice work and the whole shebang.
Right. But it is very holiday-themed in appearance. But there are many, many recipes in the book that, in fact, involve a bowl and a spoon and, even a limited baking time. One of my favorites is called Golly Polly Doodles, and it's a round little cookie with a surprising peanut butter center that takes all of 6 minutes to bake, if you can believe that.
And you have this chocolate chip and macadamia nut cookies. What distinguishes your version of that?
I always say that you bring your own DNA to every recipe. And so I'm sure that, you know, there are recipes that are familiar but done in a slightly different way. Maybe more macadamia nuts than you would think of in a normal cookie, and more chips,
but
the same great flavors.
Explain this, the chef's touch.
Well, I've done that in all of my books, and it's a section where I can put a little personal anecdote, can tell the book buyer a little something about where the recipe came from, also some historical information, perhaps about cranberries or other key ingredients in the recipe.
One of the things I loved about the book is that you say it's all within reach of the home cook, because you bought all the ingredients at the local supermarket and you bought all your bakeware at Target or somewhere like that.
Well, that's correct, Peter. And I think it's very important for a cookbook author to put themselves in a typical home kitchen and not in a professional kitchen. And that's why I've tested all my books. Five of the books were tested in my home kitchen, and then five in my test kitchen, Ganache Hill, which had high-end home equipment, not professional equipment.
Yeah, see, now, I did one cookbook with a chef that, I mean, I won't even mention, but I insisted, since they wanted people to use it, that we do that. Nobody ever did that. And I have gotten some feedback about that.
That the recipes were too
difficult. They did not test the recipes in the home kitchen.
And the recipes were too difficult.
Well, yeah, I mean, they just work different in a professional kitchen, don't they, Marcel?
Oh, it's a totally different experience. And I think if you're a professional chef and you want to do a book for consumers, that's the first notion that needs to get locked into. And that is, I will have to test this in my home kitchen or somebody's home kitchen, not in my restaurant kitchen.
Right. Now, did you finish that story about your mother? How did she get you hooked on chocolate?
Well, when we were kids, and the book has a lot of meaning for me, because my dad died just before Christmas in 1955, and my mother had given birth to my youngest sister the day before.
Oh, no.
December 23rd, and my dad died December 24th, 1955. And so my mother at 37 was widowed with six children. And and especially in the earlier years, there may not have been a lot of presents under the tree, and she tried to provide as many as she could. But one thing that she never denied us was chocolate. And she loved to bake, and she loved to make fudge and cookies and her caramels. And we had an abundance of that every Christmas.
Now, you have names attached to almost all these recipes. You know, like, let's see, what am I, Miss Junie Mae's Peanut Brittle, and hello?
Right, yes. Yeah. Well, I've always had fun in trying to create a name that makes the recipe appealing, that someone will look through a book and say, hey, you know, that looks like something I'd like to do.
Oh, but these are not real people.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Is, yeah,
in fact, the peanut butter brittle recipe is one of the, you know, there are 72 recipes in the book, and most of them are chocolate. In the last chapter, Santa's Workshop, I have some cookies in there that are used for the basis of cheesecakes, for instance, that are not chocolate cookies. And then I every year I have customers at the restaurant that have given me a tin of peanut brittle, and I thought it was remarkable brittle. And I requested the recipe for the book, and they were kind enough to give it to me, but they wanted the lady that had originally taught them how to make it. They wanted her to get the credit, and her name was Junie Mae, and she was from Isle of Wight, Virginia, and she was noted for her peanut brittle, and she taught Ann and Lou how to make this peanut brittle, and they passed on the recipe to me and been lucky enough to put it in the book.
Huh. Now, you also give tips on making Christmas presents out of these sweets?
Yes, there's a section in the book that lets people know what recipes are good for shipping, those that you could take across town if you were visiting grandma's house, or those that need to stay at home. And many of the recipes are good for shipping, and almost all are good for taking across town. And there's a handful that should stay at home, like the creme brulee. But I think that in addition to telling people what those recipes are, I've also given information on how to package things to ship.
Yeah, I think that was unique. Because you make stuff, and then you look at it and say, now how am I going to get this through the mail?
Right. What do we do now?
Now you know. Now, among your savory things, do you have signatures? I mean, you're so well known for these sweets.
That's always hard to give. You know, it's like saying, which of your children do you love the most?
Right.
It's a tough thing. But in this book, I go back again to the Golly Polly Doodle, which has one of my favorite combinations, and there are several recipes in the book like that include peanut butter and chocolate. And the Golly Polly Doodle, which is a little round cookie with and it's not very sweet on the outside. The chocolate is rather on the bitter sweet side, but there's a center of peanut butter, and the filling is made with peanut butter and confectioner's sugar, so So it's a little bit sweeter. So when you put the whole thing in your mouth, and which is the recommended way of eating it, it's really delicious.
Now, isn't there a song that goes something about golly polly doodle all day?
Let's not get that into our heads.
But is
that's true.
Can't
get rid of it.
Is that where you got the title from?
Yeah, yes, it is.
That's not an English song, I don't think.
Now, anybody can get this book, and you better get it fast because we're running out of days before Christmas. You can get it from our website, which is www.onthemenuradio.com. Go to OTM Bookshelf and just pick it right out and order it. Give us some information about you, your website, and your restaurant, if you would, Marcel.
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. The restaurant's on the Duke of Gloucester Street in historic Colonial Williamsburg, and we've been there for 27 years. And I have a business partner who runs the front of the house, and I've been in the back of the house all these 27 years. And our website is thetrellis.com, and we also have a website where we sell some of our cookies. There's not any cookies from the new book, but the Mrs. D's chocolate chip and the black gold and others are available on the Desserts to Die For website, DessertsToDieFor.com.
Right.
And having dined at the Trellis probably at least 20 years ago, listeners, I can tell you that it's an absolutely charming establishment. I'm sure there's a hot blazing fire in the wintertime. I remember when we were there, it was in the summertime, and we ate outside under the trellis, after which it's named.
That's right. And we do have not a wood-burning fireplace, but a wood-burning grill out in the dining room and in the grill room. And it does give somewhat of the same ambiance as a fireplace, but it's a particularly magical time to be in Williamsburg. And in fact, this on December 1st is the grand illumination, and that kicks off the season, the December month, which has evolved over the years to be the busiest month of the year in Williamsburg.
Oh, I'll bet. Yes, yeah, indeed.
Some people would say that Williamsburg's, in a way, is a bit commercial. I don't know. That was the feeling that we always had when we visited. But I can tell you, listeners, that this restaurant, which is right in the middle of the town, is absolutely, totally a genuine fine dining establishment that Marcel runs there. And you wouldn't expect it. And that's the only reason I mention it, because it would seem like it wouldn't be the location that would be a great restaurant, but it is.
How about that?
I
appreciate those comments.
Marcel, thank you for visiting with us.
Well, I hope we'll have you visit us in Williamsburg again.
We'll give you a call.
Yeah, we're actually due to make a trip to Virginia sometime in the spring, so we'll make a point of swinging through Williamsburg and saying hello.
Well, we'll be here.
Okay, Marcel. Have a happy holiday.
Happy holidays.
And happy Choco holidays to you and your listeners.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, thanks.
Well, that was a sweet segment, so I guess it's now time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember, you could email us, and I certainly hope you do anytime. It's onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. We love hearing from you, especially if it's something nice.
And for those of you who are not quite sure, that was Anne. And this is Peter.
You think there's a question there?
Anne's been remarking to me just within the last few minutes that I seem to have been dominating the program recently, but that's absolutely being corrected now as she's back.
Actually, that's not
involved
what I
in the
said.
Show. Well, you
that's
okay?
Not
that's not what you
I said.
Well, we're gonna have.
What I meant was, if you appear on the program in a segment, and then in the next segment I'm not there, people probably want to know what happened to me. Did you take my head off in the break?
Well, that's neither here nor there. We'll announce what happened to Anne on the website then, why not?
Okay, but meanwhile, Lisa, forgive us for all this little bantering about. We have Lisa Brock on, who's the president of Food Cuber, an ingenious gadget with many uses. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Could you describe your product?
I can. It's actually a very simple concept, and it's also my invention, and I got the idea from the concept of using your old ice cube trays to store food, which is something that, you know, they've, cooking magazines and different, you know, celebrity chefs have been telling us to do for years. So if you make that big, you know, vat of chicken stock, you don't want to have a huge frozen brick in your freezer. And they would always say, use your old ice cube trays, and then you have little cubes. And like I said, that's been out there for years.
Guess who does that, Lisa?
let me think. I'm going to narrow it down to two people.
Yeah, but the funny part about it is every time we need lemon juice, which is the biggest thing we got, we forget it's there.
Absolutely. Lemon juice is one of the big ones that I hear a lot about. Well, what's interesting is in the last few years, I started seeing a lot of magazine articles that were suggesting that you expand the use of your ice cube trays beyond the chicken stock and the lemon juice that most of us have been doing. And it said, oh, you should use your ice cube trays for pesto and sauces and butters. And it sort of went down this big, long laundry list of things. And all I'm a single mom. I've been a single mom for 10 years. And so I'm a busy working woman as well. And I just don't have time to fool around. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, what do I want to do with 50 little bricks of anything in my freezer that I don't know what the volume is? You know, because if I'm going to take the time to make a pesto or make a sauce and, you know, put it in these trays, and then I have these little cubes, when it's time for me to use it, if I needed a half a cup of something, I don't know how many of those little cubes it takes. So I have to kind of, you know, eyeball it and pull a few of them out, and then I've got to thaw them out, and then I've got to remeasure them to find a half a cup. And if it's too much, then I'm going to sort of end up throwing away that excess. And I thought, geez, I'm reading so many articles about this. I thought, why don't they make kind of the concept of an ice cube tray with multiple, you know, cubes that's easy to pour into, but something that had standardized cooking measurements so that if I needed a half a cup of something or one cup of something, it's there and I know what it is and I can just grab it out of the freezer and throw it in the pot or, you know, thaw it out.
So you didn't come at this. I thought you came at this as a way of making your own baby food and having it properly portioned.
I didn't know. That's, my children are a little older now. They're 17 and 12.
Well, yeah,
and
they don't need the baby food anymore.
Well, right. So I didn't need that. But I actually originally came at the idea just, you know, being a cook who likes to, you know, prepare things ahead and that kind of thing. But then after the idea occurred to me, and then the second thing that happened was I realized I hadn't really seen anything like that in the market. There are a few baby food systems, but they're not much better than small ice cube size portions that maybe has a lid on top, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, this is it, because I was looking around for my daughter-in-law, and most of that seemed useless. I mean, just little, you might as well just use the old ice cube things.
Well, right, and if you have, you know, if you've ever had children, you know they eat more than that. In like, by the time they're 8 months old, they're eating a lot more than those little tiny ice cube sizes.
Exactly.
So anyway, so it occurred that, you know, as I started to think about it, I thought, wow, you know what, there's a lot of people that could use this. I've also been on Weight Watchers and different diet programs that use portion control, which is most of your more reputable, you know, brand of programs. It doesn't matter what the, you know, which program you're following, but they all, you know, have some form of portion control involved, whether you're counting points or shares or exchanges or whatever. And so as I came up with the idea, it seemed like more and more people could make use of this kind of a concept. So the Food Cuber, very simply, it kind of looks like an ice cube tray, if you can envision that in your mind. And there's three different sizes of trays. There's a tray that holds two cups, so it holds two, it makes like giant, basically makes two giant cubes. Each cube is two cups. There's a one-cup tray that makes four one-cup portions. And there's a half-cup tray that makes eight half-cup portions. In order to get more use out of the trays, we put a fill line so that when you're filling it up, you know where the one-cup mark is. But we also put a half-fill line in each tray. So the half-cup tray will actually give you a quarter-cup measurement or a half-cup. Obviously, the one-cup gives you half or one, and the two-cup tray gives you one or two. And we didn't want to put too many lines in there because it just gets too hard to see. Because the concept is, you know, if I make that spaghetti sauce, I can just pour it in the tray real easy. All the cubes fill up to the line, and then there's an interchangeable lid that we put on top that has really deep-set groove, so it gets on there really nice and tight and keeps air and odor out. So if you're freezing,
yeah. So that's a really good feature, especially
Absolutely.
According to my daughter-in-law. It's a really good feature.
Absolutely.
I might throw in here that the reason that my daughter-in-law is testing it is because we have this new baby and she's making baby food, and lots and lots of people are making their own baby food.
They are.
But they don't want to invest in the very elaborate systems with the grinders and stuff like that. You don't have to do that with your system.
Oh, no, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, there's also the movement. Jessica Seinfeld has the, you know, pureeing vegetables.
She's being sued by the woman we interviewed who had the first book.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, that whole concept. No, all you have to do is...
The sneaky chef woman suing.
Yeah, sneaky chef, exactly. Yeah. Same concept. All you do is, you know, if you're making carrots, for example, you obviously prepare the carrots the way you want. You cook them, and then you just put them in a food processor. They obviously have to be pureed, but yeah. You don't need a grinder. If you get into meats and you're doing, you know, a lot of meat and things like that, you might want to. But I haven't found... What I've found is the food cubers are fitting the toddler market especially well because of the larger cube sizes.
Uh-huh.
So, and the toddlers, obviously, when you get over a one-year-old child, they're able to start to, you know, have little bits that they can chew and things like that. So you're not doing as much meat pureeing and things like
now,
that.
Now, Lisa, what was your day job?
Oh, my day job is has nothing to do with plastic kitchen gadgets. I have been in marketing for about 20 years, but I was in the financial services market.
Uh-huh.
And I actually used to, you know, manage web content for a major financial services organization here in the United States.
Well, now, Lisa, uh-huh. Let me take a different direction here. I mean, what you've got is like you systematized something that was sort of a secret way of, you know, using old ice cube trays. So what you've done is to surround it with more system. But how did you manage to figure out how to get somebody to make this for you?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. Can you just, for all those people out there,
absolutely,
with a great idea, and I at one point was one and never got my product made, although it's now on the market, but somebody else is profiting from it, not me.
Well, you know what?
How do you do that? How do you take the idea and have it a reality?
That's a great question, and I get that question quite a bit, and I'm probably a really good person to ask only because this product is so completely different from anything I had done in the past. And I really did know nothing about it at all. Well, similar to what you said, I think we've all come up with ideas at different times in our life. When I came up with this idea, I knew for sure that somebody else was going to come up with it, and I knew that if in 3 years I saw it on the shelf under someone else's name, I'd probably have to kill myself right there in the food aisle. So anyway, I first of all, I made sure I was protecting the idea because you do have to be careful. You don't want to run around and tell everybody about it because there are a lot of people out there that have the money and the means to take a good idea. And I'm not saying they're mean and evil, but they just have the money and the means that maybe a lot of people don't have to run out and make it quickly and bring it to market. So the first thing I did was look at protecting the idea, and that was to see if it was patentable. And I talked to a patent attorney, and many of them will give you a consultation for free initially, and it won't cost you money until you actually decide that, yeah, I want to pursue this. And then I opened up, I'm out in the Portland, Oregon area, I literally opened up the phone book under plastic manufacturing, and I just started making phone calls. And I said, you know, hi, I have this, I'm, you know, this woman who knows nothing about plastic, but I have this idea, and I want to ask you guys about it. And I would have a non-disclosure agreement so that they couldn't take my idea and steal it. And they would sign it, and we would sit around a table, and I had my little pencil drawings and cocktail napkins, and I would just describe what I wanted to do, and then they would tell me whether or not they thought they could help me or not. And then they were the ones that brought in the designer and the engineers and the people that could actually take, you know, your pencil drawing and turn it into this beautiful computerized CAD thing that had measurements. And,
I mean,
you know,
like, how much money does this take to get to that stage then?
Well, it obviously depends on the product that you're
right.
doing. This particular one was actually pretty expensive. I have a very dear friend who was in a financial position to invest in it, and so she went in with me as an investor and kind of as an angel. And then I was in a fortunate position to own a home that had some home equity that I could draw on. But on this particular project, it was over $100,000 because the molds for, you know, to make the plastic
right.
item are that's what's expensive. You know, when people look at plastic items, they say, oh, geez, you know, they're charging $15
yeah,
for this
yeah,
and
yeah.
it takes 20 cents to make. It really doesn't. It's actually quite a bit more expensive than that.
Yeah.
We're also doing all of our manufacturing here in the United States, which so our costs are higher. We're not doing anything in China.
So the manufacturer.
And now these are pretty. They come in bright colors.
Right now we just have a red colored lid, and the base is sort of a frosty white, and with the fill, so you can see the fill lines are very, very clear.
I thought I saw a green one too.
You might have seen a green one on the website because we were working with bringing out different colors, and we are going to be expanding our color base.
Oh, okay. So I'm not totally nuts. Okay.
Now tell us
who else can use this. We have baby food.
Yeah, there's a number of, everyone says to me, well, who's your market? Who's going to buy this? Well, what's interesting is there are very separate and distinct groups of people that can make really good use of this product. First of all, we talk about baby food and toddler food. Okay, everybody, that's kind of intuitive. And I mentioned about people that are trying to watch their weight. Even if you're not really trying to lose weight, but you're just trying to get a handle on healthy eating and good portion control, the Food Cuber is perfect for that. You make chili, you pour it in the 2-cup tray, you have two perfectly portioned, meals of chili that you can just pop out and microwave and you're all set.
I'd have four of those, by the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know about you, but if I have the big bowl of chili in the refrigerator, somehow extra scoops come out of that bowl into my bowl. So it's always good for me to know ahead of time. Another major market is pet food. Dog World Magazine is actually running a feature on us in January, in their January issue, because of a couple of reasons. Obviously, we had the major pet food scare here in the United States just a few months ago, which, made a lot of people afraid of buying commercial pet food. There's also a big movement in the pet food arena to home cook and do a more raw diet for your pet. And then there's also a trend towards more specialty dogs, the teacup chihuahuas and the little dogs, that many times have a need for a special diet or they have allergies. And so what's interesting about the Food Cuber is if you have, a little Yorkie, the half-cup tray is perfect. Or if you have a German Shepherd, the 2-cup tray, works well, too. So you can go from little dog to big dog with it.
You sound like you're having a lot of fun, Lisa.
I am. There's diabetes patients are making good use of it, obviously, because they use portion control to manage their glycemic index. We also were contacted by the National Kidney Foundation. Apparently, people that have chronic kidney disease also have a need to manage their portions to help better manage their disease. And so they were interested in learning more about it. So there's lots and lots of groups. And, of course, just the gourmet chef making pesto.
Exactly. No, don't forget the pesto. I don't forget that. How do you get it?
You can get us online right now at www.foodcuber.com, F-O-O-D-C-U-B-E-R. You can also, when you go to the website, there's a store locator link, and you can look and see how many. We're in 22 states and retail stores. I think there's about 65 stores in 70 locations, and we're expanding all the time. So what's next
in product line?
Oh, you know what? I think what's probably going to be next is we had a 1/4-cup tray size designed so that it would take you down to a 1/8 and a quarter, a smaller one.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, time and money and investment, we just didn't do that because it felt too close to just a regular ice cube tray.
Yeah.
So we'll probably expand to that 1/4 tray size. One of the things we were going to explore is possibly putting silicone in the bottom of each of the cubes, which makes them easier to push out.
Okay, that was the... Before we came on air, I told you that my daughter-in-law said that she was having some trouble getting them released, and you pointed out all you need is...
Oh, you just need a little warm water. Because they're bigger cubes and because you're using food, when they come out, they're not going to initially twist as easily as an ice cube tray would. But if anybody remembers making Jell-O molds, the first thing you did was, dip it in a pan of water or run a little warm water across the bottom.
Well, any great molded salad or dessert...
Exactly.
And as long as you
just run a little water on the bottom and they come right out. Some people have asked about getting out one cube and leaving the rest in the tray. Obviously, just take a sharp knife and just slide it down along the edge, and that cube just lifts right up out of there.
Sounds good, Lisa.
A lot of people also are taking the cubes out of the trays and then putting them in Ziploc bags and then reusing the tray.
Yeah, that makes sense too.
Yeah,
that's what I do with my ice cube tray.
Exactly.
Well, Lisa, thank you for coming on with us, and I thought that was just a great revelation, and I hit on that when I least expected to on the Food Cuber, and just when I was thinking about it.
And don't forget, with less than 10 shopping days to Christmas,
absolutely,
this is a beautiful a special gift you can give to someone who's a pet lover. You can give it to your you can give it to your son and daughter to do with their grandchildren. All kinds of things you can do with it, and it's inexpensive to mail because it's not very heavy.
Exactly.
So how about that?
It's perfect. Okay. So Lisa, let us know what your next product is.
And we'll hopefully stay in touch.
Oh, very good. Thank you for having me today.
Okay, Lisa.
Bye for now.
Ciao.
Have a great holiday.
Mm-hmm, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, how about that? Interesting lady, interesting story, and a useful product.
Yes, in fact, I used to sneer at gadgets because, I think I was overloaded with them at one point in the kitchen. But I really like gadgets.
I tell all kinds of people you love gadgets, and just to prove she loves gadgets, she had me interview somebody who's got more gadgets, and that's probably going to be the next segment of the program. So tune in again. Just tune in to us the other side of the break, and now we'll
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to email us often, if you would, because we enjoy getting your emails. The address is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. We have, as usual, a fascinating guest. Today, it's somebody I feel like I've known for years, although I've never met her before, is Molly Katzen, who is the author of what I would call an iconic cookbook, the Moosewood Cookbook, which burst on the scene, making it not only all right, but most desirable to focus on vegetables. Now, did I put that right, Molly? Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Ann, and I guess you put that very beautifully, actually.
Yeah, well, I think that you wanted to clarify when we were talking before that, your new book is called The Vegetable Dishes I Can't Live Without, and I know where that's coming from, and we'll talk about that. But you corrected me when I mentioned a vegetarian cookbook in terms of Moosewood, because that's not what you are, and that's not where you're coming from.
Yes, but I also understand that that is very much how Moosewood has been received, and that it certainly has, the Moosewood cookbook over the years has certainly given a lot of options for vegetarians. However, I do make the distinction, especially now that my new book, Vegetable Dishes I Can't Live Without, is, which is just my favorite vegetable dishes, has been, people have really been embracing it, but I often get asked, is it a vegetarian cookbook? And I guess when I hear the word vegetarian, what I think of, and I think what a lot of people think of is, whoever is a vegetarian, just don't serve them any meat. Keep the meat out of there.
Yeah.
And serve them anything but meat. But it doesn't necessarily say what they are eating. It's, to me, it's a statement of elimination of a certain entire category of food from your diet.
It's negative rather than positive.
Yeah, and I want to also say I absolutely respect and always have utterly respected the choice to not eat meat or animal products. But, in fact, it doesn't necessarily, that doesn't equate with eating a lot of vegetables. I know meat eaters who eat beautiful diets with lots of vegetables, and I know vegetarians. Who eat terrible diets.
Oh, just, that's,
you know, if it's anything but meat, it could be pizza, it could be bagels, it could be just plain pasta, but it doesn't necessarily even mean they eat vegetables. So what I'd like to do is turn the whole conversation or get the semantic orientation more towards a love of vegetables. And I can't think, maybe you can help me, I can't think of a great word for that. I call it pro-vegetabilism, and that doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. an orchard, garden and orchard-based diet, which is kind of lovely, but long-winded.
Well, we were talking about Barbara Kafka off-air, and maybe Barbara said it best in the title of her book, Vegetable Love. But
it
does sort of sound like a strange name for a diet, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, but see, it doesn't. But vegetarian doesn't necessarily is not necessarily about vegetables. It's about meat. It's about the meat not being there.
Exactly.
So I like to talk about how wonderful vegetables are and how just in every way, not just good for you, which we all know. And for some people, they know that with a grimace, and some people know that and are thrilled. But there are ways to make vegetables taste incredibly good. And to become, I've been on a roll here. Every night I roast about three different trays of vegetables in my oven at 450 degrees. And my daughter, my high school age daughter, is just going crazy over them. She can't wait to get home from school. She says to her friends, I gotta go home now. I don't want to hang out with you. My mom's roasting vegetables.
Oh, that's cool.
That's what I want. That's what I want in this world.
Of course, you're living now in a great place for fresh produce, California.
It's true. Although I have to tell you, I don't just write for people who live in California. Although it would be wonderful if everyone could get the kind of produce as available as we do. But even the humblest root vegetables that I assume you can get in Pittsburgh all year, like rutabagas and parsnips and carrots and sweet potatoes.
I love parsnips.
Oh, me too. Aren't they a revelation?
Yeah, and you know, in England they're so cheap.
The
here
difficulty,
they're so
difficulty
expensive.
Is here is they're so expensive. I mean, in England they're really inexpensive, and they're very much better. By the time we get parsnips, they've come all the way from California. They've been packed for goodness knows how many weeks. Now, you're lucky if you get a good product. I won't buy them in bags. You know, most places they come in bags, and I'll only buy them if they're loose so that you can actually pick up each one and find out if it's any good.
Well, I love roasted root vegetables. I love to cut them in kind of a matchstick shape and roast them in I love the high roasting temperature, 450 degrees,
uh-huh.
And they just kind of dry out slightly and curl up slightly, get brown and crisp around the edges. I do this in olive oil and just a tiny, little shower of salt, very light when they come out. And it's just, I find it revelatory. But my enthusiasm just doesn't go away, I got to tell you.
Yeah, Molly, how did you get to where you are? I think listeners would be interested in that. I mean, you're an East Coast person.
I was born and raised on the East Coast. I went to school, to college, partly at Cornell, and then I transferred to the San Francisco Art Institute. I was an art major.
Oh, so that's, let's mention, by the way, that you have absolutely lovely illustrations that you do. Were they pencil drawings or ink?
The illustrations in the vegetable dishes I can't live without are done with a felt tip pen that I let dry out a little bit, so it's like a sort of soft touch with pen. It looks a little bit like pencil. And Moosewood in the Enchanted Broccoli Forest, those books are all hand-lettered and illustrated with pen and ink. And then Still Life with Menu and Vegetable Heaven and Sunlight Cafe, which are some of my other books, plus my children's cookbooks, are done in color, which was so much fun. I could actually paint the illustrations for those.
Oh, that must be wonderful. I've never seen any of those.
I want to tell somebody's story out of school here and get your reaction. First of all, I'll tell you who said it, and you'll be amazed. And then I'll tell you what she said. The person in mind is Sarah Moulton,
mm-hmm.
who you would think loves and cooks everything. And we were at a meeting with her, and she came out in front of a large audience. She said, "I hate beets."
Oh yeah, she hates beets.
And,
oh my gosh, a foodie who hates beets. I've never heard of such a thing.
She said her husband once asked her to explain what it was about beets that she didn't like, and she said they taste like dirt.
Oh, she's so wrong. That's
one of my favorite vegetables.
Well, I thought you would enjoy that. We roast them. My mother-in-law used to boil them for a long, long time, and I had this wonderful idea that for me was totally creative and new. I didn't know that anybody had ever done this before. I thought you could roast them on the barbecue grill, and you would have to have the same cooking time as you did if you were boiling them, which means a medium-sized beet cooks for about 45 minutes. But I did this, and I've loved them ever since. And then I discovered that all kinds of people have been roasting beets all along, and I just didn't even know it. I thought I made it up.
Yeah.
No, I roast them all the time, and I do anything to get a beet cooked.
Yeah, me too.
I'll roast it or boil it, because once it's cooked and you get it out of its skin and slice it, that it starts to take on whatever the characteristics of whatever you're seasoning it with.
When you roast them on the grill, you don't even have to peel them, and you don't even take tail off.
It sort of caramelizes the outside. I just I just spray them with olive oil and sprinkle them with salt and pepper regularly, turn them over so they all get kind of about the same degree of char on all sides.
Now, what Molly, gives you your ideas? You have some really creative vegetable recipes here.
I like to choose. I have a pretty, in this particular book, the new book, I have pretty small selection of favorite little, what I like to call little touches, finishing touches. It's not a big, broad pantry. And the reason for that is I want to keep these recipes very accessible and pretty simple, so people won't look at that, look at them and scratch their heads and close the book and say, well, I'm too busy for this, or it's too complicated for me. I really want people to make these recipes, so I'm keeping it like at arm's reach.
Yeah,
I don't know if you say that.
Again, off air, you were saying.
And so I go for a handful of really high quality ingredients for the pantry. One of them is a very good fruity olive oil. Another is an assortment of the roasted nut oils, which are perishable.
Now, do you use the ones?
Keep them in the refrigerator. Keep them covered up tight.
Do you use the ones in California that are French tourangeau?
Yes, I love those.
Oh, me too. I thought that's how
you just blew the sound away there.
Yeah, I just absolutely love that. I love the roasted hazelnut oil Brussels sprouts is absolutely to die for.
How about pistachio?
Oh, pistachio is absolutely incredible. Another thing that is just mind blowing, one of those things that you get a taste and your mind just starts to boil. Or, you know, what is the word? Your eyes pop out of your head in a good way. Just a surprise taste is the roasted pumpkin seed oil.
Oh, yes.
Have you ever tried that?
Yeah, and the funny thing though is the color. Don't you think the color is pretty?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, we didn't get that from Tourangeau. We got it from somebody else. It's called Styrian.
Pumpkin seed oil. Where did we get that? It's green.
And it's the most incredible dark green color, and it makes everything turn green.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous. Well, they're expensive, but you just buy them once or twice a year. You keep them in the refrigerator. I keep around fresh garlic and roasted garlic, and I have on hand just an assortment of nuts, which I toast, and seeds, which I toast, a few fresh herbs, and sometimes some dried fruit is a really beautiful touch. It sounds odd to use fruit in a vegetable dish, but it can work beautifully. For example, I have a sweet and sour red cabbage with cranberries, dried cranberries, and blueberries. And it sounds so strange, but it comes out so, first of all, visually stunning. Second of all, absolutely delicious. So these small touches, I love to, my favorite thing I'd say that I mentioned a little bit earlier is the 450-degree oven. And the vegetables on a tray that's been coated with olive oil in bite-sized pieces of your choosing, of your design. And you make sure that the tray is not crowded so that the biggest surface of each piece of vegetable has the most contact with the hot oil of the tray and then the heat of the oven. And the vegetables acquire they shrink a little bit, they caramelize, and they curl around the edges, they get crisp, and it's just divine. So that would be my favorite thing to do with almost any vegetable.
Now, explain, you were saying in the before we went on air, about how everybody has permission now to use, to be able to dress the vegetables instead of having them naked.
Oh, it's such a blessing to know. And it's fairly recent information because we're coming finally, thank the Lord, we're coming out of the low-fat craze, which was driving me nuts. I wish literally, but it was just driving me crazy. That people were just lumping all oils, all fats together into one category, making them bad. You know, fat is bad, low fat is good, no fat is better. And then we would sort of assume that we would be healthier if we would eat our vegetables absolutely plain, like boiled or steamed vegetables with nothing on them, maybe a little lemon juice or something. But what's happened in recent years is that research has shown that not only is it okay to drizzle that steamed broccoli or asparagus with a little olive oil, it's actually desirable. If it's a good oil, if it's a healthy monounsaturated oil, it's very good for you. We need to get the essential fatty acids in our diet. Our body does not manufacture the essential fatty acids, which is why they're called essential. We need to take them in. And it makes the vegetables taste so much better. I mean, I can't tell you what a joy it was to write an entire cookbook of vegetable recipes knowing that olive oil, free-flowing olive oil, is desirable. It's like, get the olive oil in there now, and then everything tastes so much better.
Yeah, but it's still calories, and it's fat calories.
Yes, but they're good calories. I mean, Dr. Walter Willett of the Harvard School of Public Health.
Oh, isn't he wonderful?
He's my co-author on one of my books. Well, Dr. Willett wants wants us getting 30% of our calories from olive oil.
And I think he's brilliant.
Yes, sir. I will happily do that. And so it makes the vegetables taste better, and then it makes you want to eat more of the vegetables.
This is
true. And I'm not talking about, you know, drinking the olive oil. We're just we're just being liberal in coating the vegetables with it. It adds up, but not to that much.
Yeah, Peter wanted.
Well, there you are. There's a lecture for Miss Anne, who likes plain boiled vegetables, and and I like to put oil all over them. We had carrots and green beans last night, so I put a nice big dollop of pesto, which Anne made, and allowed it to melt all over them, and it tasted quite delicious. And
no, I love it.
She looks down the table at me with a. Looking down her nose, saying, "Yeah, you can do that because you're skinny, but you really shouldn't be doing that anyway." So I'm going to quote Molly Katzen, and I'll be fine. I won't have to put up with this anymore.
You know, if I can just make a kind of generalization about eating and calories, if people were to really hold off on getting their calories from empty white starches, such as white rice and white bread and white pasta. I mean, once in a while, but not getting the bulk of your calories from these empty white starches, and to trade some of those calories for good fat, calories that come from good fat, such as nuts, nut oils, avocado, or olive oil. It's a swap of calories, and it's a very healthful swap.
No, I agree with you.
And so it's like if you have to have a certain a ceiling on the number of calories we take in, and we all do, choose those calories carefully. And understand that some of them are going to give you greater health and greater vitality than others. And the thing that's so great is that a lot of the ones that are really good for you are also incredibly delicious. I think we have a notion in this culture that food that's good for you has to taste bad and make you miserable, but it's a noble thing to do, and that food that tastes good is bad for you and will make you fat and ugly, but it will be fun while you're eating it. I would love, if I have any mission at all, it's not to turn people vegetarian. I consider that moot. If people are vegetarian already, I respect that. But my mission is to give everyone a lot of healthy recipes and to let people really understand, lead people to really understand that they don't have to make a choice between food that tastes good and food that's good for you. It can be all the same thing.
Molly, you've done that in the vegetable dishes I can't live without. And listeners, you get this book. Order it right off of our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. And I can assure you, you're going to find vegetable dishes that you can't live without either. Molly, it's been really exciting talking to you. I wish we had more time.
I do too. It's been really fun. Thank you so
Next
much.
Next book, because you seem to make a lot of them.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question off the air. So if you could hang on while we go to the break, Molly, okay. that would be terrific.
Absolutely.
So listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this segment of the program. We certainly have had a wonderful time talking to Molly on your behalf. I think now, isn't it time to
take a break?
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Listeners, welcome back to On the Menu. Don't forget that you can track everything that we're doing at our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. And, of course, you can write to us through our website or directly at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And we've got another fascinating guest just joining us now. Ruth Goldman is the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for a company called ARGEE. Ruth, you've got some absolutely fascinating gadget-type products, which Anne asked me to talk to you about because they're gadgets that I like, not ones that she's especially bothered about. But how do you come up with these ideas?
Well, Peter, my husband is a very clever inventor, and he's a cook in the kitchen and a baker. And whenever he gets frustrated with the products that are out there, he says, "I've got to think of a better way." So would you like me to tell you how we came up with Spin and Store?
Sure. So the famous Mr. Goldman is the source of these ideas. That's wonderful.
It is. And we both use each other as a sounding board because I love to be in the kitchen as well.
Great.
And neither one of us, like everyone else, doesn't like a lot of cleanup.
Right.
So he invents products to make life easier.
Well, which product would you like to start with?
I'd like to start out with Spin and Store, the reusable salad and herb spinning bags. And he got very frustrated with the big, clunky salad spinners, taking it in and out of the cabinets, washing it, putting it back, trying to find room for it in the cabinet. And so he said, "I've got to come up with a better way." So So he came up with these wonderful reusable plastic bags that spin dry your produce, become your container, and you could take it to work. You could take salad to work, to the picnic, wherever you want to go. They don't take any room. If you have a boat, a camper, or a big, beautiful kitchen, they fit right in the drawer. And what I do with my used bags after I'm through using them and I've used up all my salad or spinach or whatever, I rinse out my bags real well, shake out the moisture, then I fold them very small and flat and store them in the refrigerator. They're cold and fresh for the next time.
Oh, no kidding. You see, what I did was I kept the wood, the cardboard box, and it hangs on a hook on the side of the refrigerator. So when I've washed them out, I fold them up, and then I put them back in there. I never thought of storing them in the refrigerator itself.
Yeah, that keeps it, you know, from getting any mold or problems. And they're out of the way and cold and ready to use for the next time. And you can use it for everything. As I say, I use parsley, cilantro, romaine, lettuce, everything you can think of, baby spinach and so forth. And they're so convenient.
And it works because it's a slightly leaky bag. That's correct?
Well, they're not. You know what happens? It's not leaky. You spin dry your produce, and this is the patented part. By centrifugal force, all the water collects at the bottom of the bag in a reservoir. Then there's a channel down the side of the bag that you pour out your water. You fluff it up. I spin again, especially if you're using field greens. You want to spin enough so that there is no more water left in your bag. So you spin again, and you hold up your bag, and you make sure that all the water is gone. You can tell by the little reservoir at the bottom whether any water collects there or not. It comes with the twisty tie. You twist it closed, and then you stick it in the refrigerator, take it to work, or use it immediately. And the beautiful part of it is also another feature is when you make salad and you put it in a bowl, that bowl is the same size forever. With Spin and Store, as you use your produce, you roll down your bag, it gets smaller and smaller, and takes up so little room in your refrigerator.
Yeah, I was very good. I managed to figure all of that out all on my own.
But, oh, good, good. Well, the package is very self-explanatory. We went, you know, through the 1, 2, 3 steps. I get a lot of rave reviews from the boaters, the campers, the mobile home people, as well as the people who have a nice big kitchen, which I'm very lucky to have.
Now, this one's been on the Today Show, right?
It has been. Jamie Oliver, the Naked Chef, had it on the show, and all the stars of the show used it. They were spinning away, and they loved it. And he especially likes healthy produce for children, you know. And, you know, with so much E. coli and things, you know, salad, prepackaged salads being taken off the shelves, this is something you are in control of. You wash your produce, you spin it with our bags, and you know you've got healthy greens, and you're in control.
Now let me pick the next one, next product, because you've been after me to try this one, and I admitted to you the other day that our daughter-in-law had, but I hadn't. So this is the Chop Keeper. So,
right.
Since your husband invented it, tell us what's special about the Chop Keeper.
Well, again, you know, being in the kitchen. And, you know, he used to make sandwiches in the morning and crumbs were everywhere, or he would make oatmeal. Oatmeal was everywhere. And on a weekend, he makes pancakes, so the flour was everywhere. He designed a chopping tray that's a patented design that has some raised, small raised sides around the tray. What that means is when you sift your flour, cut your bread, slice your meat, whatever you want to do, the juice, the particles, it's the no-fuss, no-cleanup, wonderful tray. Then he makes a sandwich now, and it becomes his placemat. He takes it right to the table. Parents tell us they love it. They can fix meals on there. There's no mess. And take it right to the table or right to the high chair or wherever. So this is a wonderful FDA-approved plastic, dishwasher safe. And I use it for everything, making salad, making hot cocoa, whatever, you know, you can make a spill, Now the spills, the particles stay right on this tray. Did you find that, Peter?
Yeah, I did, yes. Now the last item is this wonderful, it's called Le Taulet.
Le Taulet.
Le Taulet,
and this
oh boy.
Is something I was involved in because I could see the chefs on Food Network could never find their towel sometimes. My husband could never find his towel. So we came up with the idea of Le Taulet. This is a microfiber washable towel. And all in one box, you get a Velcro belt, one size fits all. And if you don't want to wear the belt, there's a retractable clip-on device, so you could clip it onto your slacks, your skirt, your apron. It pulls out, you wipe your hands, your table, it comes right back to your side. He uses it for barbecuing, so he can always wipe his hands. You could use it in the spa and the, you know, golfing, whatever. This towel is wonderful. It's always with you.
There you go now. Where do people get these wonderful products, Ruth?
Well, I suggest they can buy it on our website. They can order it online, and I will spell the website for you. It's A-R-G as in George, E as in Edward, E as in Edward, Corp, short for corporation, C-O-R-P, .com. And our 800 number is 800-449-3030. So either way, they can order these products, and they're wonderful Christmas items, perfect stocking stuffers. They're reasonably priced, and I think your listeners will really enjoy them.
Well, this sounds like the stocking stuffer gift for the person who has everything in their kitchen. Ruth, thank you so much for talking to us, and I hope you'll have a very happy holiday upcoming.
And the same to you, and thank you very much for having me.
That's fine.
All right, then.
Bye-bye. Well, this has come to the end of another exciting show of On the Menu Radio, so we hope that you'll join us same time, same place next week, right, sweetheart?
Yes, I can say bye-bye.